Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the education story when we come back. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you're paying over 14 taxes, and you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce, and the government gets 60%. That's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Well, now, isn't that just real special? And if you think your share isn't enough, well, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and then make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay those same 14 taxes just like you did this year. And you're going to net about 25%, and the government will net 75%. You know, that means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you'll net $4,000 more, or 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year. You put out 100% more effort and get 8% more for it. Now, that's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order our free general law CD package? It's free. It doesn't cost you anything. Let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is we're paying so much and receiving so little in return. Let me show you how to do just that in our Tax and Status School, which is available on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now, to order that free general law CD package, just call us direct, and the number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, you can go online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, send us an email request for that same free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? Education. It's a big issue. It costs a lot of money here in the United States. We here in the United States spend, on average, $10,000 per child in our public school system to educate them for about 180 days a year. If you multiply that out, just to give you an idea as to how much it costs to educate a child per day in our public school system, just take that $10,000 and we'll divide that by 180 school days, and it costs about $55.55 per day per child. Now, when I was a kid in school, there was six desks in each row, and there's five rows in each school room. So there were 30 students in each class, and students and teachers got along quite well with about 30-to-1 ratio. If we multiplied that out today, of course, here in this country, they say the problem with our public school systems is that we've got too many students and not enough teachers. I don't know of any schools that are teaching 60 or 90 or 120 students per teacher, but if the ratio was 30-to-1, when I went to school, Johnny learned to read and Johnny could count, or he couldn't get from the third grade to the fourth. And that was the way the game was played. And sometimes students had to stay behind a year or maybe even 2 years. But in the final analysis, when they got a diploma from high school, they could all read and they could all write. They could all do arithmetic. But that's not true anymore. And in spite of all this money that we're spending, $50 per student per day, multiply that out, times, you know, 30 students. Every day your kid goes to school in that classroom, that teacher is being paid $1,666 a day to educate that child. Now, of course, the teacher doesn't get the $1,666 a day, but the school does. Think about that. Every classroom, you got a teacher in there. And the teacher is teaching students at $55.55 a day on average here in the United States. She's got 30 students in the class at $1,600 a day. Now, listen, let me show you how this works. In the parochial school system here in America, about 3 million students go to parochial schools. Those are the Catholic schools and Baptist and Lutheran day schools. When they educate a child, for a whole year, on average, they get $2,500, $2,500 per student per year. Now, let's just divide that one out for a minute. Here's 2,500 divided by the same 180 days, and that's $13.88 a day. $13.88 a day. And that's around $15 a day. So it costs $55 a day in public school, and it costs $15 a day to send the same kid to a private school. And so, you know, right away, you got to ask yourself, why the big disparity? Why does it cost so much more to educate a child in public school than in private school? And I've never heard anyone complain that the private school system was turning out inferior students or that they were being dumbed down. In fact, Here in the United States, most people, if you ask them, would you rather send your child to a private school or to a public school? I think it would be something like maybe 100% would pick the private school. Well, then why don't Americans send their children to private school? Well, here in this country, you don't get any deductions from your tax bill if you send your child to public school versus private school. And it's worse than that. After you have paid your $55 a day tax, then you have to pay the $15 a day school tuition for the private school. So the guy that sends his kid to private school ends up paying $70 a day, but he only gets the regular $15 a day outcome. Now, here in the United States, there's a third way that we can educate children. It's called homeschool. Home. And the homeschool people here in the United States, the average cost for educating a child in homeschool is $550 a year. I think it was $556 or something like that. So that's rounded off to $600, right? So it costs $600 in a homeschool. Let's take the same 180 days, take $600 and divide that by the same 180 days in a school year. And it costs $3.33. All right, so right away somebody's going to say, well, for $55 a day, we get a superior product than we do for $15 a day or $3 a day. We'll just round it off to $5, shall we? $5 a day. So it costs you $5 in homeschool, $15 in parochial school, and $55 in public school. So naturally, we should ask the question, well, is there any way that we could quantify the outcome? Is the child, when he's being educated, is he getting a better education at home, in private school, or in public school? And yes, there is a way to quantify that. And here's the outcome. The outcome is, in a public school, you spend $55 a day, and the child, on average, will score, when you give him an achievement test, at the 50th percentile. So if you've got a pad in front of you, you write $55, and then you write 50th percentile. It's an odd way to evaluate or to measure the outcome, but I don't make these as society does, and psychologists and psychiatrists and educators, they come up with these tests and these terms. But okay, we've got a standard here, and so the education people, they say, okay, 50th percentile. Right. Now, if you educate that same child in a parochial school on average, he's going to score at the 80th percentile. 80. Instead of 50, it's 80. It's 30 higher. Wow. You get a 60% better outcome by sending the kid to a parochial school that costs you, 15, 30, 45, 60, about 25%. So you can spend 75% less money and get 60% better outcome by sending your child to parochial school. And that's why these 3 million Americans send their children to private school. You know, people like the Kennedys and the Bushes, and you know, here's President Obama sending his kid to a private school, which makes all the sense in the world. Now, why would he want to send his kid to the Washington, D.C. public school system, which is notorious for being one of the poorest in the country? But then, let me ask you this. Why is it that the Obama children get to go to private school and all the rest of the children in Washington, D.C. are forced to go to public school, which everyone can see is decidedly poorer? I mean, not just a little bit poor. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, 5%, 10%, you know, which is, you know, close enough for government work. But no, it's decidedly poor by about 75%. Now, let's take a look at these homeschools, because this one will really blow your socks off. For $555 a year, you can educate your child at home. Now, here's something that the reason I say it's going to blow your socks off. You see, in parochial school or in public school, the teachers are all certified teachers. They've been to college. They've got a teaching credential. And they're paid professionals. So we would expect paid professionals to come up with a better outcome than mom and dad at home, wouldn't we? Because the average homeschooled student or child, the parents don't have a teaching credential. That's not to say that they all don't. I mean, a lot of teachers with teaching credentials that aren't working, you know, mothers and will educate their children at home, and they have teaching credentials. I don't deny it. But most don't. In fact, as I recall the statistics, it's around 80%. Only about 20% of homeschooled children are actually being educated by parents who have teaching credentials or who are professionals, you know, professional educators. All right, so it costs $550 and they score at the 86th percentile. Your kid will score higher if you educate him at home with a parent that doesn't have a teaching credential and has never attended college for $555 a year. Now, listen to what these numbers are telling us. The more money that you spend to educate your child, the poorer the outcome will be. And yet, we're being told constantly, the problem with public school is they don't have enough money. And the solution is you pay them more money. All right, so we've been doing that in this country for the last 75 years. I mean, every time we get bad numbers from the Department of Education, they tell us how poor the children are doing in public school. They come along and they say, well, see, it's obvious that we need more money. So we vote in more money, bigger schools with more amenities. And now they're telling us that, well, see, the problem is that the class sizes are so big. No, the class sizes today are smaller than they were 30 years ago, smaller than they were 50 years ago, smaller than they were 75 years ago. In fact, I'll tell you, I went to a Lutheran day school. One teacher taught 8 grades, and there were 50 students in the class, so it was 50 to 1. And this teacher wasn't teaching just first graders or second graders or third graders. He was teaching all 8 grades from first grade to 8th grade, 1 through 8. And he divided the whole room up into little groups. And so the first graders, there's about, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 8, something like that in the first grade. Second grade, another little circle of desks over there in that little group, and there's 5, 6, 8 in that group, and so on over there. There was Kendall Nelson was the one student in the 8th grade. He only had 1 8th grader. As I recall, there were 7 7th graders, 6 6th graders. There were 6 5th graders. That was the grade I was in. There were 6 of us. 6 times 8 is 40. And the guy had 50 students, a little bit more than that, 52 or 3. And they made a great deal out of that. I said, wow, here's look at Mr. Witt. He has 50 students that he teaches in 8 grades. Let me tell you, every student in that school graduated from the first grade to the second, second to the third, third to the fourth, fourth, and so on. And every one of them could do the work because you couldn't go from the third grade to the fourth unless you could do your work. You could not get out of the fourth grade unless you could do your multiplication tables. I remember that story. You had to be able to say 12 times 12 is 144, 10 times 10 is 100, 9 times 9 is 81, and 7 times 7 is 49 by rote. I mean, you had to know all of your times tables from 1 to 12. 1 times 12 is 12, and 1 times 1 is 1, and 6 times 6 is 36. To get to the 5th grade, you had to be able to do that. That was just one thing you had to know. And if you couldn't do it, well, maybe by the time you finish the 4th grade 3-4 times, you'll be able to do that. Now, today we call that outcome-based education. What kind of an outcome are you going to get? 50 years ago, it was common practice. Today, it isn't. And there's a wide gap or outcome that's coming from our children in these three forms of education here in the United States. And I would submit that you're probably suffering from the same debilities in Canada and Australia and Europe and every place else. Now, the Japanese did a study here in the United States. And I'm not saying that all the public school systems around the world are bad. In Japan, for instance, they took a look here in the United States, and they came to a conclusion, and they said, we can't find a single process that goes on in the public school system in America that we would emulate in Japan. So the Japanese educators, they came over here, they took a look around, they said, we can't find a single thing here in America that we would be willing to take back to Japan. Now, when we test our students here in America against Japanese students, the Japs always win, every time. If you compare American students against students in almost any country in the world, except for the third world countries, like Uganda or Rhodesia, the old Zimbabwe or something like that, we can beat those guys. So we're not down at the bottom, but we're certainly not ahead of the Germans or the French or the Japanese or the Russians or Chinese or anybody else, not in any of the industrialized countries. And we have a system here in America with compulsory education. If you don't send your kid to school, they'll take them away from you and put them in foster care, and then they'll put them in public school. And, of course, government always puts them in public school. They never educate them in a homeschool environment or in a parochial school. And we have a big union here called the National Education Association, the NEA. They're just absolutely opposed to homeschool and parochial schools. Got to hit them. Well, it makes all the sense in the world if you think about it, because they get paid that $1,666 a day per teacher on average in the average schoolroom here in the United States because of the public school largesse. If they were in Catholic or some other private school, they'd be making how much less is that? $15 a day, 15 versus 50, 15, 30, 45, 60. In round numbers, about 75% less. Isn't that sick? Isn't that just sick? But this isn't being done accidentally. It's being done on purpose. So if you think that, you want to wring your hands and say, oh, what should we do to correct this? Well, the answer should be pretty obvious. Jerk your kid out of public school and educate him at home. And the minute you say that, the parent says, oh, my God, I'm not qualified. I couldn't do that because I don't have a teaching credential. I never went to college. I wouldn't know what to do. All right. I hear you. But remember the numbers. There's 2 million or about 3 million now. 3 million Americans, 80% of which haven't been to college, and they are educating their children at home. And they're educating their children and getting the best results for the least money. Now, what that tells you is that the more money that you throw at education, the dumber your kid will become. So when I hear the government say, let's spend more money on education, what they're really saying is, let's dumb our children down one more notch. That's what it boils down to. I didn't make up these numbers. I'm just reporting what these numbers come out of the Department of Education. Hell, these are the same incompetent teachers that get paid $1,600 a day to educate 30 children. And Mr. Witt, when he was educating 50 children, remember back in 1950 or 51 or 52, I don't know how much that guy was getting paid, but as a percentage, you know, just taking a look today, he was getting about 25% of what a public school teacher gets. And he was doing the job and doing more than. He never complained. I never hear any complaints coming from parochial school teachers or homeschool teachers. They seem to accept the wages and benefits that they're receiving. But the public school teachers, they complain constantly. They're never getting paid enough. They've always got too many rowdy kids. They've got too many children in their class. They're never satisfied. They get paid more than anybody, do the poorest job, and complain the most. And the people of America seem to love it because they just lap it up and they pay more. When the government comes out and says, we need more money for public schools, the people line up to go to the polls to vote for a higher bond issue or more money for the public schools. So I thought, gee, maybe we ought to take a look at it and see, do you really want to do that? Now, I'm not here to abolish the public school system. I'm not here to abolish the NEA. Here in the United States, it divides up about like this. You have about 3 million children in parochial school and about 3 million children in private homeschool and about 50 million children in public school. The people of America have spoken by their actions, by 50-6, that they prefer public school. And that's just the numbers. And why should I get in the way of 50 million students who want to go to public school, or in this case, probably 100 million parents who want to send their children to public school? But there's a few of us out here that take a look at this and say, you know, I wish I didn't have to send my kid to public school. So I thought, well, let me show you how to take your kid out of public school, educate your child at home, and get a better outcome if that's what you want. Now, you know, maybe you want your kid to end up dumb. Maybe you don't want a child that's smarter than you are. And after all, that's your choice in life. But let me give you a little background here. In 1819 in Prussia, the first compulsory schooling for children was instituted. And according to educator John Taylor Ghetto, society in Prussia was divided into children who will become policymakers, and then children who will become assistants to those policymakers, such as engineers, architects, lawyers, and doctors. And then there will be the third group, the children who will be the vast, massed, used. And Prussia set up a three-tier school system in which one half of 1% of the population was taught to think. They go to school, and the school is called Akademie. Then 5.5% of the population go to real schooling, where they partially learn to think, but not completely. And that's because the Prussians believed that their defeat at the hands of Napoleon was caused by people who were thinking for themselves at times, especially at times of stress on the battlefield. And they were going to see to it that scientifically this could not happen again. Now, the lowest 94%, now think about this in the form of a pyramid, 94% at the bottom, 0.5% at the top, 5.5% in the middle. That's the lowest 94% that go to Volksschulen, where they were to learn harmony, obedience, freedom from stressful thinking, and how to follow instructions. They worked out a system that would, in fact, guarantee those results. In the Volksschulen, it was to divide whole ideas, which really simultaneously participate in math, science, social thinking, language, and art. They divided them up into subjects, which hardly had existed before, to divide the subjects further into units, to divide the time into small enough units of time, with enough variations in the course of a day, no one would know what was going on. In the middle of the last century, a member of the secret Skull and Bone Society in the United States, following in the Russian or the Prussian tradition, set in motion an American educational revolution that has subverted the entire system towards the goals of the New World Order. That man's name was Daniel Coit Gilman. He was the first president of Johns Hopkins University and of the Carnegie Institute. Gilman studied Hegelian philosophy at the University of Berlin in 1854 and 55, and also at the University of Berlin during the same time was the earlier mentioned Wilhelm Wundt, who was a key player in applying Hegelian-styled psychology to the whole world. Gilman came from a family of bonesmen, and after he returned from Germany in 1856, he became treasurer of Skull and Bones. Simultaneously, Gilman became assistant librarian at Yale and was appointed to the position of head librarian 2 years later. During the same period, Skull and Bones covertly took over the administration of Yale University with the presidency of the school from that period forward and turned over to a succession of Illuminized Bonesmen. That's according to the Iconoclasts, published in October of 1873. Now, they have obtained control of Yale University. Its business is performed by them. Money paid to the college must pass into their hands and be subject to their will. No doubt they are worthy men in themselves, but the many whom they looked down upon while in college cannot go far or so far forget as to give money freely into their hands. Men in Wall Street complain that the college comes straight to them for help instead of asking each graduate for his share. The reason is found in a remark made by one of Yale's and America's first men. He said, "Few will give, but Bones men, and they care far more for their society than they do for the college." The Woolsey Fund was put, and it was but a struggling existence for kindred reasons. Here then appears the true reason for Yale's poverty. Yale University is controlled by a few men who shut themselves off from others and assume to be their superiors. Now, Gilman met with Frederick Gates, who ran the Rockefeller Foundation, and he implored him to set up the Southern Educational Board, merging the Slatter and Peabody funds, and Gilman called the foundation the General Education Board, signaling his intentions. The organization was later renamed the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, Gilman was the first president of Johns Hopkins University, and he carefully chose for the faculty members from the Skull and Bones and other groups of the Hegelian stripe. And among those was a fellow named G. Stanley Hall, the first of once American students to make a mark. Hall's training in Leipzig was paid for by a loan from a member of Scroll and Key, which is a sister society to Skull and Bones at Yale. In Leipzig, Hall immersed himself in Hegelian-inspired psychological studies taught by materialist psychologists like Hartmann, Helmholtz, and his greatest influence by Wundt. Then, returning to America in 1883, he took over the psychological laboratory at the new Johns Hopkins, and he started the American Psychological Association and the American Journal of Psychology. And according to Hall, the psychology that I taught was almost entirely experimental and covered for the most part the material that Wundt had set forth in the latter and larger edition of Psychological Psychology. In 1889, Hall was chosen as the first president of the newly established Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hall was the mentor of one of the most influential names in American education in the century. His name was John Dewey. Now, Dewey studied under Hall at Johns Hopkins, moving on to teach at the universities of Michigan and Minnesota. Another major influence upon Dewey was the Hegelian philosopher George Sylvester Morris, who had received his doctorate from the University of Berlin. And according to Dewey, echoing the sentiments of his Prussian mentors, "There is no God, and there is no soul, and there are no needs for the props of traditional religion." Now, with dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed natural law or permanent moral absolutes. Now, that's pretty important, boys and girls, so I'm going to put a bracket around those three statements. And let's think about those as we're pursuing our goal here of finding out why it is that the public school system costs so much and produces so little. You know, if the public school system were costing us $10,000 a year per student, and they were turning out students that could read and write, and they were at least equal to the parochial schools or close to it, you know, we could sit back and shut up. But when you take a child and spend $10,000 on him, and then compare that with a child that you're spending $2,500 on, and you get a 75% better outcome by spending 75% less money, why would you want to spend 75% more to get 60% less? You know, that doesn't make any sense, does it? Well, Dewey published the first American textbook on Hegelian philosophy as applied to the Wundt psychological innovations in his book Psychology. By 1895, he joined the faculty of the Rockefeller-funded University of Chicago, heading the philosophy, psychology, and teaching departments, and establishing an education laboratory called the Dewey School, later known as the Laboratory School of the University of Chicago. Dewey followed the Wundt example in his insistence that education was not the teaching of mental skills, such as reading and writing, but rather in channeling of raw experiencing to the evolving mind of the child, a sort of psychic Skinner's box version of education. This, then, changed and created the traditional role of the teacher as educator, and it was replaced by the new teacher as a shrink, a socializer, and a psychologist. Teachers are not in the public school system to teach. They're not there to educate. They are there as socializers and psychologists and psychiatrists. It's a mental control process. That's the purpose for public school. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, again, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about the education story, and the opening of the education story gives us a little background as to why public schools are as poor as they are. The answer is fairly simple. The public school system is not there to educate. It used to be. That used to be the purpose. That's no longer true. The purpose is psychology. What we're trying to do is to socialize your child. We are not there to educate him to think. Most students actually believe or think that they can think. The problem here in America is the people of America can no longer think. They are guided, they are molded, they are directed, and they follow what they have been taught. That's the purpose for education. Education is designed, according to the dictionary, to inculcate into the minds of the younger generation those values of the older generation. So in the old days, if a man was a machinist, he would teach his child to be a machinist. If he were a blacksmith, he'd teach his child to be a blacksmith, and so on down the line. So we had definite values and definite goals, and in a broad society where everybody educates his own child, well, you have a great diversity. These people think, and they think for themselves. And they have to think for themselves because they have to compete with everybody else in society. But in the Hegelian dialect, we're not in competition with anybody else. We are specifically taught and trained to be lawyers. And then we are put into a monopoly where nobody else can participate. We have no competition. And so we just go out and rape, rob, and pillage everybody as lawyers. Medical doctors do the same thing. They go through the training program. They're not taught to think. They're taught to respond, and they respond beautifully. They are, in fact, medical doctors, the only thing they know. And as a result of that, they're probably real good medical doctors, and they go out and they have a closed union. It's a closed union shop. It's a monopoly. You and I cannot participate in medicine. And if we do, they'll put us in jail. And so the doctor doesn't have to compete in society. He doesn't have to think. It's already pre-programmed. All he has to do is show up at the hospital and do his thing, and he gets paid, and he walks out the door, and that's the end of the argument. Now, there are some of us out here that can still think, and that's because we're in competition with everybody else around us. And I have to compete with everybody else around me. I don't have this monopoly. So I have to be able to think. I've got to be able to figure out a better way, invent a better mousetrap. To just give you an illustration, I run a law school. Now, how many of you have ever heard of the Gordon Law School? Well, how many people in America have heard of the Harvard Law School? If you want to test this, go out and do it. You go out and you ask 10 people, have you ever heard of the Harvard Law School? And see how many people say, well, yes, I've heard of the Harvard Law School. Then you might add to that, well, then you know that the Harvard Law School exists, don't you? Okay. Now I ask them the second question, have you ever heard of the Gordon Law School? I'll bet you that if you were to just ask 10 people at random if they'd ever heard of the Harvard Law School, I think about nine or 10 of them are going to say yes. And if you ask, have you ever heard of the Gordon Law School, I think that you're going to hear 10 out of 10 say, never heard of it. Okay, this is my point. I compete very effectively with the Harvard Law School. That's right. The George Gordon Law School competes very effectively. I am not complaining. I do not have a monopoly on law or law schools. I am not complaining about the Harvard Law School having more money than I do or having a bigger name or anything else. I have more students than I can teach. I'm not complaining at all. I can compete with Harvard, Yale, and Princeton Law School every day of the week. And I have to be able to think, how can I attract students here when nobody even has heard of me? All right, now that's my point. I've made it. Now let me tell you a little bit more here about the right stuff. This came from an article published in American Opinion, I believe it was, some years back now. It's called The New American, August 8th, 1994. Pretty old article. And it says, what went wrong? Every year, our public schools turn out millions of young adults who are unprepared for the task of living responsibly in a free society. And the most alarming news is, it was planned that way. Well, I introduced you to the planning. The planning didn't just happen in 1994. It went back to about, 1776 with a fellow by the name of Wundt, W-U-N-D-T. He was a German fellow. And he had some ideas. And after all, in the world of today, in fact, of the world period, different people have different ideas. There are people out there that are communists, and they think that communist politics is just the cat's meow. Well, there are other people out there that are Nazis, and they think that National Socialism is the cat's meow. Then there's Republicans and Democrats and capitalists and socialists and Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, just on and on it goes. People everywhere have political ideologies. They have religious ideologies and economic beliefs and ideologies, and they advance those. And they say, hey, my system's better than yours, and you should follow my system. And these people, they're probably sincere, and I wouldn't argue with them for a minute. I'm not here to tell you that you shouldn't be a socialist, a communist, a Republican, or a Democrat. But I always encourage my students to think about, well, of what value is it? Now, for instance, let's take a little test here of thinking ability. When you hear your president say to you that the problems with American education today are overcrowded schoolrooms and underfunding. Overcrowding and underfunding. All right, let's assume that there is overcrowding. And let's assume that there is underfunding. What's the solution? Well, you need to turn out more teachers so that we have more teachers per students. That will cut down on the overcrowding or the high ratio of students to teachers. And then what do we do about underfunding? Well, we raise taxes and we spend more money. Shouldn't we then ask, why do we want to do that? Because we want smarter children. We want a better outcome. Instead of the child scoring at the 50th percentile, we want our children to score at the 55th percentile, 60, 65, 70. Or let me ask you this. Is the purpose for more teachers and smaller classes and higher taxes and more money spent to produce a lower outcome? We don't want our children to score at the 50th percentile. We want our children to score at, say, the 45, 40, 35, or 30th percentile. Is that what we want? Is that why we're spending more money and lowering the class size? I'm just asking you, what is your goal? What is it that you want to accomplish? I don't know. You tell me. I would presume that for most of you out there, when I come to you and I say, let's think about this for a minute. President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, and President Bush before him, and Ronald Reagan before him, I cannot remember a time in my lifetime that presidents and academians and college professors and everybody that's in the power structure hasn't been coming to us and saying, we need more money for education and smaller class sizes so that we can have smarter children. Hell, they're all making that claim, aren't they? All right. Now, what actually happened starting about 1950? We spent more money, we lowered the class size, and the children score poorer and poorer every year. Now, after this goes on for a long time, I don't know how long it has to go on, but, you know, after this goes on for 25 years, 50 years, 75 years, is that long enough then to take a look back at the results that we're getting and then come to a conclusion? I'll let you be the judge. Now, remember, we have some really poor schools. Remember, on the national level, the national average in public school is that your child will score at the 50th percentile. So my presumption is 100 is perfect and 0 is zero. That is, this kid can't talk, can't walk, can't go to the bathroom by himself. And then at 100, he's a genius. He just knows everything, and he's just real smart. are you spending this extra money? Did you vote for that last bond issue on your school district or in your school district because you wanted your child to score at zero or as close to zero as possible? Or did you want your child to score higher than 50? Maybe you wanted him to score at 60 or 70 or 80? All right, because here's the results you get. In Washington, D.C. and in New Orleans, those two school districts have the notorious distinction of being the poorest in the United States. They are the poorest school systems. They spend more money and turn out the dumbest kids in the nation. All right. Now remember, on average, it costs $10,000. But in those school districts, it costs $17,000. Got that? It costs 70% more to educate your child in Washington, D.C. or New Orleans. And there's an outcome. On average, they will score at the 28th percentile. Get this. For $10,000 a year, your kid can score at the 50th percentile. For $17,000, he can score at the 28th percentile. I asked the question before the break. I said, well, what was it that you wanted to accomplish here? What's your objective? I don't know. You tell me. Now, I had some children, and I looked at my children, and I said, well, I guess I need to educate these kids. And so the question came up. My wife and I sat down. We thought about it for a while. Well, where do we want to send little Teddy? And we thought, well, we'll send him to private school. I had the money to do it, and so I sent my child to private school. And the reason that I did that was because I had a belief that phonics, teaching a child phonics rather than sight reading, would be better for him. So I spent the money, and I had to pay my taxes, and then I had to spend extra. I sent him to private school, and he turned out just exactly the way I thought he would. He learned how to read. He learned how to read through phonics, and as far as I know, he's a pretty good reader to this day. I wanted my child to receive the best possible education that I could give him, and I was willing to spend the money to do that. Now, I could have sent him to public school, but I said, no, I don't think public school is as good as private school. In fact, I don't know of anybody in America, I have never talked to anybody anywhere at any time in my lifetime who has ever said to me, oh, no, public school is far superior to private school. I have never heard anybody say that. I don't believe anybody believes that. Certainly the people like the Obamas and the Bushes and the Kennedys and those that send their children to prestigious Ivy League colleges like Harvard and Yale and Princeton do not believe that. There may be some people down here in the slums of Chicago that believe public school is better and more advanced than is the private schools, but I've never met one. So if they exist, I don't know it. Now, let's take a look now at where we're at. If you spend $17,000 and educate your child in the Washington, D.C. public schools, he will score at the 28th percentile. If you take your kid and educate him in any other public school in America, on average, he'll score at the 50th percentile. If you send him to the private schools, on average, he will score at the 80th percentile. And if you educate him at home, you will educate him to the 86th percentile. Now, these are averages. Of course, I will concede that there are probably some homeschool children that are scoring close to zero, which is what we're after, isn't it? But, hey, wait a minute. Hang on here a second. On average, they score at 86. All right, now let's over on the other column here. Just keep moving to the right. When we're spending $17,000, we get a 28th percentile. That's the lowest we can achieve so far. If we can spend $34,000 a year educating that child, I think we can lower it to 14th percentile. That seems to be where these numbers are taking us, isn't it? All right, now let me run through all four of them. Your kid's going to an inner city public school, costs $17,000 to educate him, he scores at 28. You upgrade him, you take him out of the inner city school and educate him in the suburbs, he scores 50. And it only costs $10,000. If you jerk him out of there and send him to private school, it costs you $2,500 to educate him, and he scores at 80. You jerk him out of there and you educate him at home, he scores at 86, and it only costs $555. Boys and girls, the less money you spend on the education of your child, the smarter he will become. And that's right out of the Department of Education of the United States. Right out of the big boys' numbers. Now, why it is that Americans want to spend more money for lower class sizes, I have no idea. None. It's insane. It makes absolutely no sense. It doesn't add up. It certainly isn't economical, but that's what we have, that's what we want, and that's what we vote for every single election, which leads me to believe that Americans cannot think. After all, if Americans could think, I don't think they would send their children to public school. I don't, I didn't, and I wouldn't. So I'll leave it to you. I know somebody's going to write me a letter and say, well, you dumb jerk, you're stupid, and you're the guy that can't think. I always get those. know, in spite of the numbers, in spite of the logic, in spite of the facts, there's just always people out there that can't think. Well, let's think about this. A person who cannot think, do you think that a person who cannot think can think? That's almost like going to an insane asylum and asking the inmates, can you give us an evaluation of your mental health? How in the hell can a person who is mentally incompetent give you an evaluation of his own mental competence? Hell, that's preposterous on its face, isn't it? So if you've got a nation of people that can't think, how in the hell can the people that can't think give you an evaluation as to their mental capacity? And yet every day I hear somebody say to me, we need to get this message out, Mr. Gordon, and tell all the people of America what's going on around them so that they can vote the bad guys out and vote the good guys in. And I say to myself, my God, can these people think? I don't think so. Listen to this. Boys and girls, we have been voting in this country since 1776. We are in a pickle. We are in a god-awful mess. Everybody that I talk to will agree. The president will agree. Republicans and Democrats agree. America is in a god-awful mess. And the people are telling me the solution to this god-awful mess is to vote. Boys and girls, if voting was the solution to the problem, there wouldn't be any problem. Because we've already been voting for 227 years, haven't we? And 227 years of voting hasn't solved the mess. It created the mess, didn't it? My God, didn't you people vote Clinton in? Didn't you vote Bush in? Didn't you vote all the bad guys in that now need to be voted out? So I don't think voting is the solution to the problem. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the cause of the problem, but I come to a conclusion, it sure as hell ain't the solution, is it? Well, assuming we can still think. All right, I'm out of time. I'm going to have to reduce the story at this point to a reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.